Miramax Films presents A Band Apart. Uma Thurman. In black and white, a bride, her face battered and bloody, lies on the floor.
Do you find me sadistic? No, kiddo. I'd like to believe you're aware enough, even now, to know that there's nothing sadistic in my actions. This moment, this is me at my most masochistic.
Bill, it's your baby.
The same woman, her face now unblemished, drives an open-topped car.
Looked dead, didn't I? Well, I wasn't. But it wasn't from lack of trying, I can tell you that. Actually, Bill's last bullet put me in a coma. A coma I was to lie in for 4 years. When I woke up, I went on what the movie advertisements refer to as a roaring rampage of revenge. I roared, and I rampaged, and I got bloody satisfaction. I've killed a hell of a lot of people to get to this point. But I have only one more. The last one. The one I'm driving to right now. And when I arrive at my destination, I am gonna kill Bill.
Volume 2, a film by Quentin Tarantino. Chapter 6, Massacre at Two Pines. A whitewashed Texan chapel stands in the middle of a vast expanse of scrubland.
Now, the incident that happened at the Two Pines wedding chapel that put this whole gory story into motion has since become legend. Massacre at Two Pines. That's what the newspapers called it. The local TV news called it the El Paso, Texas Wedding Chapel Massacre. How it happened, who was there, how many got killed, and who killed them changes depending on who's telling the story. In actual fact, the massacre didn't happen during a wedding at all. It was a wedding rehearsal.
Now, when we come to the part where I say you may kiss the bride, you may kiss the bride, but don't stick your tongue in her mouth. This might be funny to your friends, but it would be embarrassing to your parents.
The assembled friends giggle.
We'll try to restrain ourselves.
There are four of them, plus the bride and groom.
Y'all got a song?
They all look towards the man in sunglasses, smoking at the organ.
How about Love Me Tender? I'd play that.
Sure.
Love Me Tender be great.
The preacher.
Rufus, he's the man. Rufus, who was that you used to play for?
Rufus Thomas.
Rufus Thomas. Rufus Thomas.
I was a drill, I was a drifter, I was a coaster, I was part of the gang, I was a bar K. If they come through Texas, I done played with them.
Rufus, he's the man.
The unshaven preacher in a suit and tie turns to the woman at his side.
Oh, yes, you forgot the seating arrangements.
Thank you, Mother.
Yes. Now, the way we normally do this, we have the bride's side, and then we have the groom's side. But since the bride ain't got nobody coming, and the groom's got far too many people coming...
Well, yeah, they're coming all the way from Oklahoma.
The bride smiles at her friends.
Right. Well, I don't see no problem with the groom's side sharing the bride's side. Do you, Mother?
I don't have a problem with that. But, honey, you know, it would be good if you had somebody come. You know, as a sign of good faith.
Well, I don't have anybody. Except for Tommy and my friends.
You have no family?
Well, I'm working on changing that.
Mrs. Harmony, we're all the family this little angel's ever gonna need.
The bride turns round to her.
I'm not feeling very well, and this bitch is starting to piss me off. So while you all blather on, I'm gonna go outside and get some air.
Reverend, sorry. She's gonna go out and get some air.
Yeah, given her delicate condition. She just needs a few minutes to get it together. She'll be okay.
holding her veil in her hands and smiling to herself. The bride, her pregnant belly pushing at the white fabric of her wedding dress, drifts slowly towards the open door. But as she becomes conscious of the flute playing, her smile vanishes and her step falters. She looks briefly back at her husband-to-be, then out towards the door. Her eyes widen, her lips part, and her expression becomes a complex mixture of joy and fear. For a moment, she seems to tremble as she holds her hand up to her throat, twisting the veil between her fingers. She swallows and continues towards the door. On the threshold, she pauses, turning her head to look out onto the chapel porch. She takes the last few steps out into the open air and stands leaning against a spindly pillar on the edge of the portico, staring out over the flat, featureless landscape. She turns her head sideways and sees the flute player, sitting to one side of the door, blowing at his pipe. A faint smile plays around her open lips. The man is in his 60s, lean, with a weather-beaten face and long, grizzled, swept-back hair. Slowly he raises his head and looks up at her.
Hello, kiddo.
How did you find me?
He shrugs.
I'm the man.
And smiles with narrowed eyes.
What are you doing here?
He glances at his flute.
What am I doing? Well, a moment ago I was playing my flute.
Putting it down on the bench at his side, he stands up. He wears a dark jacket, collarless shirt, and cowboy boots.
This moment, I'm looking at the most beautiful bride these old eyes have ever seen.
He leans against the opposite pillar.
Why are you here?
Last look.
She looks at him skeptically.
Are you going to be nice?
I've never been nice my whole life. But I'll do my best to be sweet.
She takes a step towards him.
I always told you, your sweet side is your best side.
I guess that's why you're the only one who's ever seen it.
He steps towards her.
See, you got a bun in the oven.
She takes another step.
I'm knocked up.
Jeez, Louise. That young man of yours sure doesn't believe in wasting time, does he?
Have you seen Tommy?
They stand toe to toe.
Big guy in the tux?
Yes.
Then I saw him. I like his hair.
She throws him a look.
You promised you'd be nice.
No, I said I'd do my best. That's hardly a promise. But you're right. What does your young man do for a living?
He owns a used record store here in El Paso.
Ah, music lover, eh?
He's fond of music.
Aren't we all?
She raises her eyes and looks at him steadily.
And what are you doing for a J-O-B these days?
I work in the record store.
Ah, so. It all suddenly seems so clear.
They smile at each other dangerously.
Do you like it?
Yeah, I like it a lot, smartass. I get to listen to music all day. Talk about music all day. It's really cool. It's gonna be a great environment for my little girl to grow up in.
As opposed to jetting around the world, killing human beings, and being paid vast sums of money.
She pushes her face close to his.
Precisely.
Well, my old friend, to each his own. However, all cockblockery aside, I am looking forward to meeting your young man. I happen to be more or less particular whom my gal marries.
You want to come to the wedding?
Only if I can sit on the bride's side.
You'll find it a bit lonely on my side.
Your side always was a bit lonely. But I wouldn't sit anywhere else. You know, I had the loveliest dream about you.
Oh, here's Tommy. Call me Arlene.
You must be Tommy.
Uh-huh.
Arlene's told me so much about you. Honey, you okay?
Oh, I'm fine. Tommy, I'd like you to meet my father.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God, this is great. I'm so glad to meet you, sir. Oh, Dad.
The name's Bill.
Well, it's great to meet you, Bill. Arlene told me you couldn't make it.
Surprise.
That's my pop for you. Always full of surprises.
Well, in the surprise department, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
When did you get in?
Just now.
Did you come straight from Australia?
Of course.
Daddy, I told Tommy that you were in Perth mining for silver and no one could reach you.
Lucky for us all, that's not the case. So, what's this all about? I've heard of wedding rehearsals, but I don't believe I've ever heard of a wedding dress rehearsal before.
We thought, why pay so much money for a dress you're only going to wear once? Especially when Arlene looks so goddamn beautiful in it. So, we're going to try to get all the mileage we can out of it.
Bill takes her hand.
Isn't it supposed to be bad luck for the groom to see the bride in her wedding dress before the ceremony?
Well, I guess I just believe in living dangerously.
The bride looks wary.
I know just what you mean.
Son, some of us have places to be. It's your duty.
Look, we got to go through this one more time. So, why don't you have... Oh, my God. What am I thinking? You should give her away.
Tommy, that's not exactly Daddy's cup of tea. I think Father would be much more comfortable sitting with the rest of the guests.
Oh, really?
That's asking a lot.
Huh. Okay, we'll forget it. But how about we go out to dinner tonight, celebrate?
Only on the condition that I pay for everything.
Deal. We gotta do this now.
Can I watch?
Absolutely, have a seat.
Which is the bride's side?
Right over here.
Tommy leads his bride towards the preacher.
Mother, here we go.
Bill stands midway down the aisle.
Now, son, about them vows.
The bride walks back down the aisle to Bill. A tense smile on her face.
Bill, I just don't want...
You don't owe me a damn thing. If he's the man you want, then go stand by.
With a plaintive smile, she cups his face in her hands and kisses him gently on the lips. Letting her hands rest on his cheek, she pulls away with a rueful look, then slowly puts on her veil. Tearfully, she kisses him on the lips again and briefly lets her head rest against his.
Thank you.
Bill watches her walk away from him towards Tommy. Outside the tiny chapel, three women and one man, all wearing black, converge towards the porch and the open doors. The man wears dark glasses. The three women wear close-fitting trousers and tops. One has blonde hair, one dark. And one has her hair beaded in long afro locks. All four carry automatic submachine guns. They bring them to their shoulders and walk purposefully up the chapel steps.
What the hell?
The chapel basks in the hot sun as the screen fades to black. The film turns from black and white to colour in a pale, hot, dusty landscape of rocky hills. Bud, a heavily tattooed, broad-faced man in his 40s with stringy dark hair under a white Stetson, sits in his vest and jeans in the door of a rundown trailer home.
You're telling me she cut her way through 88 bodyguards before she got to O'Rin?
No, there wasn't really 88 of them. They just called themselves the Crazy 88.
How come?
I don't know. I guess they thought it sounded cool. Anyhow, they all fell under her Hanzo sword.
She's got a Hanzo sword?
He made one for her.
Didn't he swear a blood oath to never make another sword?
It would appear he has broken it.
Bud holds an old coffee tin as a spittoon.
Them Japs sure know how to hold a grudge, don't they? Or maybe you just tend to bring that out in people.
I know this is a ridiculous question before I ask it. But you haven't by any chance kept up with your swordplay.
I pawned that years ago.
You hawked a Hattori Hanzo sword.
Yep.
It was priceless.
Well, not in El Paso, it ain't. In El Paso, I got me $250 for it. I'm a bouncer in a titty bar, Bill. If she wants to fight with me, all she's got to do is come down to the club and start some shit, and we'll be in a fight.
He swings at his bottle of liquor.
I know we haven't spoken in some time. And the last time we spoke wasn't the most pleasant. But you've got to get over being mad at me and start becoming afraid of me, because she is coming, and she's coming to kill you. And unless you accept my assistance, I have no doubt she will succeed.
Bud's alcohol-deadened eyes slowly fill with an expression of wisdom and compassion, and he looks up at Bill with a rueful smile.
I don't dodge guilt, and I don't chew out of paying my comeuppance.
Bill shrugs.
Can we just forget the past?
Bud runs his tongue over his lips thoughtfully.
That woman deserves her revenge. We deserve to die.
He raises his eyebrows speculatively. Then his face breaks into a smile.
Then again, so does she.
The brothers eye each other evenly.
So I guess we'll just see, won't we?
Chapter 7. The Lonely Grave of Paula Schultz. Shortly after sunset, a pickup truck pulls into the parking lot of a nightclub. Bud switches off the lights and gets out, a cigarette dangling from his lips. He strolls into the empty club, past pool tables and a pole dancing catwalk. A solitary dancer sits at the bar, talking to a barman.
Late again. Bud, can't you tell time?
Bud looks around.
There ain't nobody in here, man.
Is that Bud?
Yeah.
Tell him to get his fucking ass back here.
Okay. Bud, Larry'd like a word with you.
In a cluttered back office, Larry, the owner, is sitting at a desk, snorting coke.
Take a hit. Be somebody, baby.
He pushes the mirror and a rolled paper to a dancer dressed in a lace robe. As she snorts one of the lines of coke, Bud appears in the doorway.
You looking for me?
Bud doesn't answer. Larry, in a denim jacket, jeans, and long dark sideburns, scowls up at him.
I don't know what the car was you worked before you came here that let you stroll in 20 minutes late, but it wasn't owned by me, and I own a fucking car wash.
Do you want me to leave?
No, I don't want you to leave. I want you to sit and wait. Larry, there ain't nobody out there.
Bud shrugs hopelessly.
Larry, what's your plan? That you're not needed here? My point is, I'm the bouncer, and there ain't nobody out there to bounce. You're saying that the reason that you're not doing the job that I'm paying you to do is that you don't have a job to do?
Bud gives this some thought.
No. Is that what you're saying? What are you trying to convince me of exactly? That you're as useless as an asshole right here?
Larry touches his elbow.
Well, guess what, buddy? I think you just fucking convinced me. Let's go to the calendar. It's calendar time. Calendar time for Buddy. Okay, you working tomorrow?
Yeah.
No, you're not. You don't even know what fucking day you work. Here, you're not working tomorrow. You're working Wednesday. Here you are. There you go.
Working Thursday?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Friday.
Bud shrugs.
I don't... There's your name.
If you say so.
There used to be your name. Okay? Saturday. There used to be your name. Monday, you go to... How about that? Fucking with your cash is the only thing you kids seem to understand. Okay? I want you to go home till I call you. Till I call you. Before you leave, talk to Rocket. She's got a job for you to do.
He stares balefully at Bud.
That fucking hat. That fucking hat. How many times have I told you? Don't wear that fucking hat here. How many?
Bud deliberately pulls the white Stetson low over his eyes.
Well, customers wear hats.
I'm not the boss of the customers. I'm the boss of you. And I'm telling you that I want you to keep that shit kicker hat at home.
Bud's eyes roll lazily upwards as he considers the brim of the offending hat. He takes it off and holds it in his hands. Then, without looking up at Larry, ambles back out through a stainless steel kitchen area, pausing to light a cigarette on the way. He goes into the dim but gaudily lit bar area. A leggy redhead in a short black feathered negligee follows him to the bar.
Yeah, Bud, honey, the toilet is at it again. There's shitty water all over the floor.
Okay. Rocket. I'll clean it up.
Mm-hmm.
Later, Bud drives back to his trailer home. He gets out of his old pickup truck and slouches towards the door of the tatty, corrugated trailer, pausing to flick open his lighter. He hesitates, leaving the cigarette unlit, and turns his eyes to the surrounding hills and peers thoughtfully into the darkness. Seen from the nearest hilltop, Bud's trailer home, truck, and accumulated junk sprawls untidily across the barren valley floor, illuminated by the single porch light above the trailer door. Bud stares at the hilltop as if it is staring down at him. He takes off his hat, cocks his head as if listening, runs a tongue thoughtfully over his lips, and goes inside. In a pool of black shadow under the slab-sided trailer home, the bride, wearing a black ski mask pulled over her mouth and nose, lies flat on her stomach. Her eyes flash in the darkness as she listens to the noises coming through the floor above her head.
How many times have you heard someone say, if I had his money?
She rolls over and slides out from beneath the trailer. In her hand is the Hanzo samurai sword, which she slowly draws from its black, lacquered sheath.
So hard to find one rich man in ten with a satisfied mind.
Wearing a shiny brown leather jacket, dark jeans, and a belt with a knife in a sheath, she peers through the crack at the bottom of the door. Bud's cowboy boots are visible, moving slightly as he rocks himself back and forth in a rocking chair. With her sword held perpendicular in both hands, the bride slowly stands up, her back to the trailer wall next to the door. She presses herself flat against the side of the trailer as Bud comes to the window. He opens the grimy, louvered glass, and while changing his shirt, peers out through the gap between the slats. The bride is out of sight below his line of vision. He closes the louvers and moves away from the window. The bride transfers her attention back to the trailer door.
How many times have you heard someone say...
She peels off the ski mask and opens the door. From the rocking chair, Bud fires a shotgun into her chest. She flies back out through the door and lands on her back in the dust, writhing. Bud gets out of the chair and takes the needle off the record player. He comes to the door and down the steps towards her.
That gentled you down some, didn't it?
Shotgun over his shoulder, he looks down at her and kicks the Hanzo sword away. He reloads the shotgun.
Yep. Ain't nobody a badass with a double dose of rock salt dug deep in their tits.
She moves her arm weakly.
Not having tits.
He squats down beside her.
It's fine. As big as yours. I can't even imagine how bad that shit must stink.
Her leather jacket is open, her shirt covered in blood. He takes the knife from her belt and throws it away.
I don't want to, neither.
She turns her head, her face covered with dust, her eyes streaming, flecks of blood on her lips, and spits in his face. In return, he squirts a huge gobbet of brown tobacco juice over her face.
I win.
He stands and pushes at her with his boot, rolling her over onto her stomach, and pulls out a syringe. He stabs the needle into her buttocks. Her hand scrabbles weakly in the dust and her head flops forward. Bud stands up, slings the shotgun over his shoulder, and goes back into the trailer. He reappears, swigging from a bottle, and comes down the steps to where an assortment of chairs are assembled around an improvised barbecue. He sets the tin can spittoon on the mesh grill, slumps down into one of the chairs and dials a number on a mobile phone. A woman of about 40, with long blonde hair, cruel lips, and a black eye patch over her right eye, answers. She smokes a cigarette.
Bill.
Wrong brother, you hateful bitch.
But.
Bingo.
And to what do I owe this dubious pleasure?
Bud gets up.
I just caught me the cowgirl. Ain't never been caught.
Did you kill her?
Well, not yet, I ain't. I shot her full of rock salt. She's so gentle right now, I could perform her coup de grace with a rock. Anywho.
He squats down and picks something up from the sand.
Guess what I'm holding in my hand right now?
What?
Brand spanking new Hattori Hanzo sword. And I'm here to tell you, Al, that's what I call sharp.
How much?
Well, that's hard to say, being that it's priceless and all.
What's the terms?
You get your bony ass down here first thing in the morning with $1 million in folding cash, and I'll give you the greatest sword ever made by a man.
The woman taps the ash off her cigarette and gives an evil smile.
How do you like the sound of that?
Sounds like we got a deal. One condition.
What?
She must suffer to her last breath.
Well, that, little darling, I can pretty much damn well guarantee.
Then I'll see you in the morning, millionaire.
Standing over the bride's inert body, Bud flips the phone shut and slips it into his back pocket. Later that night, a pale full moon shines down from the sky. The bride lies on her side with her eyes closed, her feet in their brown leather cowboy boots are trussed tightly with a leather belt, and her hands are bound in front of her with rope. Her fingers flex uncertainly, and her lips move as she begins to regain consciousness. Bud unhooks the tailgate of his truck and looks down at her.
Wakey, wakey. Eggs and bakey.
He hauls her out and drags her across the ground by her feet. They're in a graveyard. Headstones are visible in the background. Bud looks over towards one of them. The bride follows the direction of his eyes. Shovelfuls of earth fly out from in front of one of the headstones. Bud leans over the young woman and smiles. She closes her eyes.
I'm done! Get me out of this hole!
Bud takes off his white Stetson and saunters over to the grave, where the head and shoulders of a short, stout, bearded man in a baseball cap have appeared. He grabs him under the arms and hauls him out of the hole. The man brushes down his clothes. Bud reaches into the grave for a stepladder. The man helps himself to a can of beer from a cool box. Bud throws the stepladder into the truck. He looks down at the bride. The gravedigger joins him.
Oh, look at those eyes. This bitch is furious.
What did I tell you? Is she the cutest little blonde pussy you ever saw? Or is she the cutest little blonde pussy you ever saw?
I seen better.
He swigs from the can. Bud looks down at her, raising the brim of his Stetson.
You got anything to say?
Petrified, she shakes her head.
White women call this the silent treatment. And we let them think we don't like it.
You grab the feet, I'll get the head.
She struggles violently as they lift her up.
Hey! 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 Whipple worm. You see this?
An aerosol.
You see it, don't you?
He holds it right up to her eye.
That's a can of mace.
His finger is over the spray button.
No. You're going underneath the ground tonight. And that's all there is to it.
He looks down at her without expression.
But when I bury you, I was going to bury you.
He reaches into his jacket and brings out a shiny silver torch.
It is.
He shines it into her eyes.
But if you're gonna act like a horse's ass, I'm gonna spray this whole goddamn can right in your eyeballs. I'll burn them right out of your fucking head. Then you're gonna be blind. Burn them. And buried alive.
He shows her the torch in one hand and the aerosol of pepper spray in the other.
Now what's it gonna be, sister?
Her terrified eyes slide over towards the torch and she nods at it. Bud puts them both away.
That's a wise decision.
He hauls her upright. Moments later, she lies on her back in a plain pine coffin. Bud stands over her, holding the coffin lid. They lock eyes.
This is for breaking my brother's heart.
He fits the lid in place, and he and the gravedigger hammer it shut. A tiny sliver of light remains at the top of the coffin. as the last nail is hammered home. She is engulfed in total darkness. She switches on the torch. She batters at the coffin lid. Her mouth opens in a silent scream. The torch goes out, plunging her into darkness. She gets the light working again and clutches it to her chest. The beam shines up onto her neck and face. Flinching with each shovelful of earth, she bangs her head against the coffin base. As she struggles, the torch flashes on and off. She shines the torch along the top of the coffin. She switches the torch off. Chapter 8. The Cruel Tutelage of Pai Mei. Some years earlier, lit by the flames of a campfire, Bill plays his oriental flute. On the other side of the flames, a figure lies on its side, watching and listening.
Once upon a time, in China, some believe around the year 1003, head priest of the White Lotus Clan, Pai Mei, was walking down a road, contemplating whatever it is that a man of Pai Mei's infinite powers would contemplate, which is another way of saying who knows.
The bride smiles up at him.
When a Shaolin monk appeared on the road, traveling in the opposite direction, as the monk and the priest crossed paths, Pai Mei, in a practically unfathomable display of generosity, gave the monk the slightest of nods. The nod was not returned.
He blows across his pipe.
Now, was it the intention of the Shaolin monk to insult Pai Mei? Or did he just fail to see the generous social gesture? The motives of the monk remain unknown. What is known were the consequences.
The blonde-haired bride, her head propped up on her hand, her blue eyes shining with delight, listens, smiling, as the light from the flames plays across her face.
The next morning, Pai Mei appeared at the Shaolin Temple and demanded of the temple's head abbot that he offer Pai Mei his neck to repay the insult. The abbot at first tried to console Pai Mei,
Only to find Pai Mei was inconsolable. So began the massacre of the Shaolin Temple and all 60 of the monks inside at the fists of the White Lotus. And so began the legend of Pai Mei's five-point palm exploding heart technique.
And what, pray tell, is the five-point palm exploding heart technique?
Quite simply, the deadliest blow in all of martial arts.
He tucks the pipe under his arm.
He hits you with his fingertips at five different pressure points on your body, and then lets you walk away. But once you've taken five steps, your heart explodes inside your body, and you fall to the floor. Dead.
Did he teach you that?
No. He teaches no one the five-point palm exploding heart technique. Now, one of the things I've always liked about you, kiddo, is you appear wise beyond your years.
He whirls the pipe around his head like a sword.
So, allow me to impart a word to the wise. Whatever Pai Mei says, obey.
She looks at him gravely.
If you flash him, even for an instant, a defiant eye, he'll pluck it out. And if you throw any American sass his way, he'll snap your back and your neck like they were twigs.
He twirls the flute in his hand.
And that will be the story of you.
And brings it to his lips. Later, in daylight on a hillside, Bill comes down a long flight of ancient stone steps towards a jeep, a livid bruise on his face. The bride, in jeans and a t-shirt, her blonde hair and a girlish ponytail, slides off the hood of the jeep as he approaches.
He'll accept you as his student.
What happened to you?
Nothing.
Get in a fight?
Friendly contest.
Why did he accept me?
Because he's a very, very, very old man. And like all rotten bastards, when they become old, they get lonely. Which has no effect on their dispositions, but it does teach them the value of company.
He loads her up with rucksacks from the back of the jeep.
Just seeing those steps again makes me ache. You're going to have a lot of fun carrying buckets of water up and down that fucker.
He climbs into the driver's seat.
When will I see you again?
That's the title of my favorite soul song of the 70s.
What?
Nothing. When he tells me you're done.
When do you think that might be?
That, my dearest, depends entirely on you. Now remember, no sarcasm, no back talk. At least not for the first year or so. You're going to have to let him warm up to you. He hates Caucasians, despises Americans, and has nothing but contempt.
She smiles nervously.
So in your case, it might take a little while. Adios.
The bride turns towards the stone steps. She hoists a rucksack onto her shoulder, picks up a bag in each hand, and sets off up the steps. The top of the steps lies out of sight ahead of her, and soon the bottom of the steps is out of sight below her. She climbs on. Finally, the upward curving tiled roof of a traditional Chinese temple gateway appears. Beneath it, a squat stone building pierced by a single archway. The bride passes through the gateway, up more steps to an enclosed circular garden where a figure sits waiting. She walks towards the man, her expression a mixture of skepticism and reverence. He has a head of straight white hair pulled up at the front into a topknot, secured with a long pin. At the back, it falls down around his shoulders. His almond-shaped, bushy, white eyebrows are perfectly groomed. A thin mandarin beard and drooping moustache fall almost to his waist. He is dressed in a black-and-white ankle-length robe with a high-necked white tunic and trousers. The blonde woman lets her bag slip to the floor, kneels in front of him, and says, "Master." Yellow subtitles appear. "Your mandarin is lousy," he says. "It causes my ears discomfort. You bray like an ass. You are not to speak unless spoken to. Is it too much to hope you understand Cantonese?" She looks disheartened. "I speak Japanese very well. I didn't ask if you speak Japanese. I asked if you understand Cantonese." "You are here to learn the mysteries of Kung Fu, not linguistics. If you can't understand me, I will communicate with you like I would with a dog. When I yell, when I point, when I beat you with my stick." The young woman bows her head. "Bill is your master, is he not?"
"Yes, he is."
Pai Mei strokes his long white beard with slow, deliberate downward movements. "Your master tells me you're not entirely unschooled. What training do you possess?"
"I am proficient in Tiger Crane style, and I am more than proficient in the exquisite art of the samurai sword."
"The exquisite art of the samurai sword? Don't make me laugh. Your so-called exquisite art is fit only for Japanese fatheads." "Your anger amuses me. Do you believe you are my match?" "No." "Are you aware I kill at will?"
"Ha."
"Yes." "Is it your wish to die?" "No."
"No."
"Then you must be stupid. So stupid. Rise and let me look at your ridiculous face. Rise." She gets slowly to her feet, facing him, but with her body turned sideways. "So, my pathetic friend, is there anything you can do well?" "What's the matter? Cat, got your tongue?"
"Hi."
"Oh, yes, you speak Japanese." "I despise the goddamn Japs." The bride sullenly raises her eyes. "Go to that rack," he says. She shrugs off her rucksack angrily and goes to the wooden weapon rack. Remove the sword. The young woman goes back towards him, flourishing the sword. She comes on guard, the blade over her head. Pai Mei stands, shakes the folds out of his cloak, and walks slowly but purposefully towards her. "Let me see how good you really are. If," he says, complacently stroking his beard, "if you land a single blow, I'll bow down and call you master." She attacks him, hands behind his back. He dodges every blow. Somersaulting, he throws her to the ground. She leaps to her feet. He jumps up onto her blade. "From here, you can get an excellent view of my foot." With a kick to her head, he backflips off the blade. "Your swordsmanship is amateur at best." She attacks again, and again he dodges every blow, disarming her and throwing her against a wall. "Your so-called kung fu is really quite pathetic," he says, throwing the sword back into its place in the rack. "I asked you to demonstrate what you know, and you did. Not a goddamn thing. Let's see your tiger crane match my eagle's claw." He holds out one hand shaped like a talon. She flexes her neck and moves around him in a wide circle. She raises her own hands and advances on him, slashing and kicking. He counters her every move. Clasping her forehead, he throws her to the ground. She gets to her feet and attacks again. Again, he avoids her, hands behind his back. She grabs his throat. He throws her off with a thrust of his neck. She kicks him in the groin. He traps her foot between his legs and spins round, throwing her to the ground and standing with his back to her. She rushes at him, a large stone in her hand. He twists her arm behind her back. Like all Yankee women, all you can do is order in restaurants and spend a man's money. Excruciating, isn't it? Yes. If it was my wish, I could chop your arm off.
No, please don't!
It is my arm now. I can do what I please. If you can stop me, I suggest you try.
Fuck it!
I can't, she says. Because you're helpless? Yes. He strokes his beard. Have you ever felt this before? No. Compared to me, you are as helpless as a worm fighting an eagle. Yes. That's the beginning, he says, throwing her to the ground. She nurses her wrist. Is it your wish to possess this kind of power? She nods.
Yes!
He gazes down at her. Your training will begin tomorrow, he says, stroking his beard with an extra flourish. Pai Mei smashes his fist through a thick plank of wood. Since your arm now belongs to me, he says, I want it strong. Can you do that? I can, she says, but not that close.
Wo can, but not that shui.
Then you can't do it. What if your enemy is 3 inches in front of you? What do you do then? Curl into a ball? Or do you put your fist through him? Now, begin, he says, walking away. The bride puts her hand to the plank, touching it with her fingers as a guide to distance, then makes her hand into a fist and punches the wood. She does it again. Her face contorts with pain, and she flexes her bruised knuckles before making her hand into a fist once more. This time she takes skin off her knuckles. Pai Mei returns to watch. It is the wood that should fear your hand, not the other way around. No wonder you can't do it. You acquiesce to defeat before you even begin. Stroking his beard with a sideways flick, he goes. The bride turns back to the plank held vertically between two carved wooden uprights. Later, she climbs the steps carrying two buckets of water on a yoke across her shoulders. She practices kung fu. Pai Mei watches and instructs. He strikes her over the head, using the stick with which he is beating out the rhythm of the exercise. Silhouetted against a red background, she performs her kung fu exercises. In her tiny sleeping cell, she wakes from a dream. Silhouetted against the red background, Pai Mei and the bride perform their exercises, one shadowing the other. She carries water up the steps and pummels the plank. Pai Mei beats out the time on the ground with his stick and strokes his beard with an approving nod. In their Spartan eating quarters, the bride tries to pick up a mouthful of rice with her chopsticks. Her hands tremble, and the rice spills. Pai Mei lifts his bowl of rice to his nose and sniffs approvingly, forking the grains into his mouth with the chopsticks. Leaning low over her bowl, with bruised and trembling fingers, the bride can't control the sticks in her hand. Eventually, she casts them away in frustration. She picks up the rice in her fingers. If you want to eat like a dog, he says, taking the bowl from her, you can live and sleep outside like a dog. He throws the food to the floor. If you want to live and sleep like a human, he pushes his bowl at her. Pick up those chopsticks. He gives her a glacial stare. She pulls the bowl of rice towards her. She picks up her chopsticks and tries to collect some rice with them.
Mm.
She perseveres. Pai Mei watches implacably. At last, the bride manages to lift a mouthful to her lips. Pai Mei strokes his beard with a satisfied expression and drains his bowl of tea. Back in the graveyard, an area of freshly dug earth lies in front of a headstone marked Paula Schultz. Inside the coffin, the bride switches on the torch. Methodically, she shines her beam around the edge of the coffin lid, ending up at her feet, her cowboy boots band with the strong leather belt. She starts trying to wriggle her feet out of the boots. She looks down, pulling at each leg in turn. Gradually, like a snake sloughing its skin, the boots start to work loose. She smiles and pulls her feet free. Slowly, using her heels, she maneuvers the boot up between her legs to where she can reach it with her bound hands. She grasps the boot by the toe and carefully drags it onto her chest. Gripping the torch between her thighs so that her hands are free, she reaches into the boot and brings out a cutthroat razor. She opens the blade and tries to maneuver it into a position where she can cut the rope that ties her wrists. She reaches down for the torch and holds it in her mouth. Finally, she twists the blade round so that it's in contact with the rope. The rope parts. She smiles triumphantly and lifts the blade to her lips. She frees her wrists completely, slips the razor into her back pocket, and starts to press and tap at the underside of the coffin lid. She uses her fingertips to judge the distance from the wood.
Okay, Pai Mei. Here I come.
And she forms her hand into a fist and closes her eyes. Blood from her knuckles begins to stain the pale wood. And the planks that make up the lid start to split. Earth pours into the coffin like water, and the bride claws upwards through the soft soil. Above ground, a hand bursts out of the newly dug grave. The bride heaves her head and shoulders out of the clinging earth. For a moment, she seems to sink back down. But clawing at the soil with her fingers, she heaves herself free. She lies face down on the grass, her brown leather jacket torn, her jeans filthy. Rolling onto her back, she stares up at the night sky. Sometime later, a man behind the bar of an all-night diner sips from a mug and gazes out of the window. The bride walks across the road, her face and body caked with drying earth, trailing a plume of dust like a comet. Her shirt is stained with dried blood. Primly, she sits down at the counter.
May I have a glass of water, please?
Chapter 9, L and I. L roars down a desert highway in a late 70s black Pontiac Firebird with the roof panels off. The wind whips her long blonde hair around her face and black eye patch. She swerves onto a dirt track. Trailing a plume of dust behind it, the car bounces down the track, threading its way between low, brown desert hills towards Bud's trailer home. Bud stands in the open doorway, in jeans, his hair disheveled, bare-chested, a gold razor blade medallion around his neck. Elle gets out of the car. Wearing a black jacket and tight black trousers, and carrying a red canvas suitcase, she saunters up to the door. A pitiless sun shines down from the sky. Like something out of a classic western, a slender figure walks out of a shimmering mirage, slowly becoming larger as she draws near. It is the bride. Behind her, a range of mountains. In front, a flat, stony desert floor. She still wears the jeans and pale, blood-stained shirt she was buried in. Her feet are bare, her face flecked with blood and dirt. She walks on doggedly through low, arid, corrugated hills, picking her way over dry runnels and bare, wind-eroded slopes. Using her hands to help her climb, she scrambles up the last few steps of a rocky ridge, gets to her feet, and gazes at the view ahead. In the sun-baked valley below, Bud, bare-chested, is opening the door of his trailer, and Elle is just pulling up in her Trans Am. The bride watches, her blue eyes resolute. Bud empties a tray of ice.
I have to give it to you, Bud. That's a pretty fucked up way to die. What's the name on the grave she's buried under?
Paula? Schultz.
He tosses the ice cubes into a blender as Elle writes down the name in a small, spiral-bound notebook.
Can I look at the sword?
That's my money right there in that red bag, isn't it?
It sure is.
Well, then, it's your sword now.
Elle ambles over to look at it. Bud pours tequila and margarita mix over the ice cubes. Elle unsheathes the sword.
What's that you said?
So this is a Hattori Hanzo sword.
That's a Hanzo sword, all right.
Bill tells me you once had one of these of your own.
Bud opens a cupboard.
Once?
Yeah, how does this one compare to that?
He takes down two washed and clean food jars and slops some margarita slush into each one.
If you're going to compare a Hanzo sword, you compare it to every other sword ever made, wasn't made by Hattori Hanzo.
Picking up both jars, he hands one to Elle.
Here you go. Wrap your lips around that.
He flops down on the couch, pulling the red suitcase towards him and resting his leg on it. Elle sits opposite him in the rocking chair.
So, which jar are you filled with?
What?
They sip their drinks.
They say the number one killer of old people is retirement. People got a job to do. They tend to live a little bit longer so they can do it. I've always figured that warriors and their enemies share the same relationship.
Elle crosses her legs.
So now that you're not going to have to face your enemy no more on the battlefield, which are you filled with? Relief? Or regret?
A little bit of both.
Or shit. I'm sure you do feel a little bit of both. But I know damn well that you feel one more than you feel the other. And the question was, which one is it?
Regret.
You know, you gotta hand it to the old girl. I never saw anybody Buffalo Bill the way she buffaloed Bill. Bill thought she was so damn smart, and I tried to tell him. She was just smart for a blonde.
He stands, picks up the suitcase, walks past blonde Al, puts the suitcase on a small table, and opens it. It is crammed with bundles of dollar bills. He looks up at Al.
Thanks a bunch.
She toasts him and bites on an ice cube. He takes out a couple of bundles, puts them on the table, and picks up some more bundles. Concealed beneath them is a black snake. It strikes repeatedly at his face. Bud spills the suitcase on the floor and thrashes about the room, clutching his face. Elle watches impassively. He sinks to his knees amid the dollar bills and collapses onto his back. Elle lights a cigarette.
I'm sorry, Bud. That was rude of me, wasn't it? Bud, I'd like to introduce my friend, the Black Mamba. Black Mamba? This is Bud. You know, before I picked that little fella up, I looked him up on the internet. Fascinating creature, the Black Mamba. Listen to this.
She sits down in a chair close to Bud, takes out her notebook, and removes the cigarette from her lips.
In Africa, the saying goes, in the bush, an elephant can kill you, a leopard can kill you, and a black mamba can kill you. But only with the mamba, and this has been true in Africa since the dawn of time, is death sure. Hence its handle, Death Incarnate. Pretty cool, huh? Its neurotoxic venom is one of nature's most effective poisons, acting on the nervous system, causing paralysis. The venom of a black mamba can kill a human being in 4 hours, if, say, bitten on the ankle or the thumb. However, a bite to the face or torso can bring death from paralysis within 20 minutes. Now you should listen to this, because this concerns you.
Bud gulps convulsively.
The amount of venom that can be delivered from a single bite can be gargantuan. You know, I've always liked that word, gargantuan. I so rarely have an opportunity to use it in a sentence. If not treated quickly with antivenom, 10 to 15 milligrams can be fatal to human beings. However, the black mamba can deliver as much as 100 to 400 milligrams of venom from a single bite.
Bud's swelling eyelids close.
Now, in these last agonizing minutes of life you have left, let me answer that question you asked earlier more thoroughly.
She stubs out her cigarette on the tabletop.
Right at this moment, the biggest R I feel is regret.
Her face hardens.
Regret that maybe the greatest warrior I have ever met her end at the hands of a bushwhacking, scrub, elky piece of shit like you.
She leans back in her chair.
That woman deserved better.
With a final twitch, Bud's body stops moving. Elle shakes her long blonde hair contemptuously and gets up. She kneels down and starts tossing bundles of dollar bills back into the suitcase. She reaches for her cell phone.
Bill, I have some tragic news. Your brother's dead. I'm so sorry, baby. She put a black mamba in his camper. I got her, sweetie. She's dead. Let me put it this way. You ever start feeling sentimental? Go to Barstow, California. When you get here, walk into a florist and buy a bunch of flowers. Then you take those flowers to Huntington Cemetery on Fuller and Guadalupe. Look for the headstone marked Paula Schultz and lay them on the grave. Because you will be standing at the final resting place of Beatrix Kiddo.
Marty Catroser?
Here.
Melanie Harhouse?
Here.
Beatrix Kiddo?
Here.
Look, I can be there in about 4 hours. You want me to come over? No, you need me, baby. I'm there.
Elle zips up the suitcase, picks up the sword, and opens the door.
Okay. I'm leaving now. You go smoke some pot or something. I'll be there soon.
A flying dropkick. Beatrix, the bride, kicks Elle in the stomach, pushing her back into the trailer. The two blondes trade blows. As Elle tries to draw her sword, Beatrix snaps the aerial off the TV and slashes it in Elle's face. Face to face, they grapple in a trial of strength for possession of the half-unsheathed Henzo sword. Beatrix pushes Elle down onto the kitchen counter, the blade at her throat. Elle kicks her shin, then headbutts her. Beatrix staggers back. They run at each other with flying kicks. Both fall to the floor, winded. They get to their feet. Elle has the sword. Beatrix grabs a floor lamp. Beatrix falls over a chair onto her back and grabs Bud's coffee tin spittoon. Elle wipes the brown goo from her face.
Gross.
She attacks. Beatrix knocks the sword from Elle's hand. They trade punches and kicks. Beatrix picks up a heavy lamp. Elle kicks her to the far end of the room and takes a running leap after her. Beatrix ducks. And Elle crashes through the wall into the bathroom. Beatrix scrambles after her and grabs her from behind in a headlock. Elle stamps her heel into Beatrix's foot and clambers to her knees. Beatrix still has her arm around Elle's neck and clings on to her back. Beatrix forces Elle's head down into the filthy lavatory bowl. Elle gropes for the cistern handle and flushes it. She kicks Beatrix away. The fight spills into the corridor and then to Bud's bedroom. Elle kicks Beatrix to the floor. As Elle strides back to the main room after the sword, Beatrix spots another sword in Bud's golf bag. There's an inscription on the blade.
To my brother Bud, the only man I ever loved. Bill.
The two women face each other at opposite ends of the narrow corridor, each with a samurai sword.
What's that? Bud's Hanzo sword. He said he pawned it. Guess that makes him a liar now, don't it?
Beatrix stares at the blonde in the eye patch.
L. B. Something I've always been curious about. Just between us girls. What did you say to Pai Mei to make him snatch out your eye?
I called him a miserable old fool.
Bad idea.
Know what I did? I killed that miserable old fool. How do you like the fish head? Miserable old fool. I poisoned his fish heads.
El, you treacherous dog, says Pai Mei in flashback. I give you my word.
And I told him, to me, the word of an old fool like you is worth less than nothing.
Pai Mei collapses and dies.
That's right. I killed your master. And now I'm going to kill you too. With your own sword, no less. Which in the very immediate future will become my sword.
Bitch. You don't have a future.
They face each other, slowly raise their weapons, and balance, knees slightly bent, weight on the balls of their feet. The bright steel blades flash in the dingy light. The expression on the bride's mud-caked face is hard and determined. Elle's red lips wear a faint but cruel smile. Their swords lock and they push against each other's blades, their faces inches apart. Beatrix jabs her fingers into Elle's eye. Elle falls back into the bathroom. Her face bleeding, she thrashes wildly on the floor. Beatrix holds Elle's eyeball in her hand. Drops it on the carpet. And with her bare foot, treads on it. The black mamba hisses as Beatrix walks past it, sheathing her sword. Beatrix pushes open the door and looks out at the distant desert hills. With a last glance back at Elle, staggering and lurching around the shattered bathroom, Beatrix painfully steps down from the trailer home. The door blows back in the wind, shutting the black mamba and the blind woman inside. Last chapter. Face to face. A layered, misty mountain range frames the far horizon. The pale foreground resolves into a dense plantation of oil palms. The trees, thinning out slightly, reveal a dirt road. A pale, aquamarine VW open-top sports car comes bursting over the brow of the hill, stirring up a cloud of yellow dust behind it as it thunders over the stony track. As the car speeds along, the trees cast shadows across its rounded bonnet. Beatrix's blonde hair whips out behind her as she steers. Despite the bumpiness of the road, she looks unswervingly straight ahead of her, her eyes shielded by tinted glasses, a hint of a cool smile hovering on her lips. She pulls up outside a street bar, shaded by a tree. It is called the Botanero Cochon. A young Mexican woman carrying a plastic laundry basket looks up at her from the entrance. Behind her, a chubby girl in a baseball cap drinks from a bottle. Beatrix gets out of the car.
Like most men who never knew their father, Bill collected father figures. The first was Esteban Vallejo. Esteban was a pimp and a friend of Bill's mother. He ran a brothel in Acuna, Mexico for over 50 years. His army, the Acuna Boys, made up of the fatherless offspring of his whores, ran Acuna. He ran the Acuna Boys. Now at the age of 80, it would be this retired gentleman of leisure who could point me in Bill's direction.
She strolls up to a white-bearded man.
Señor Esteban Vallejo?
Smoking a cigarette in a holder, he looks up from his book.
Yes.
May I join you?
He takes off his spectacles.
Only on the condition that you call me Esteban.
May I join you, Esteban?
Please.
He gestures to a chair and puts the hardback book he was reading on the table in front of him.
Americana?
Yes. I speak a little Spanish, if you prefer.
No. I prefer English. I haven't spoken in a while. Well, I would relish the opportunity to converse with such a pretty companion as yourself.
It's my pleasure to be in the company of such a fine gentleman as yourself.
I must warn you, young lady, I am susceptible to flattery. How may I be of service to you?
His brown eyes search her face. She leans forward, keeping her hands down by her sides.
Where's Bill?
You must be Beatrice. I can see the attraction. I remember when Bill was only 5 years old. I took him to the movies. Even a movie starring Leonard Turner. The postman always ringed twice with Jungle Fields. And whenever she would appear on the screen, Bill would begin composedly to suck his thumb to an obscene amount. And I knew from this very moment this boy was a fool for blondes.
Beatrice shakes her blonde hair with a mirthless smile. Esteban takes a drag of his cigarette.
Mm-hmm. You know, being a fool for a woman such as yourself is always the right thing to do. We have met when I was back in business. You would have been my number one lady.
Esteban winks conspiratorially at Beatrix.
Well, I'm flattered.
You got the one better me.
He points to her car.
This? I didn't hear you were driving a truck.
My pussy wagon died on me.
The pussy day.
He takes another lugubrious drag at his cigarette.
Bill shot you in the head, no?
Yes.
I would have been much nicer. I would have just cut your face.
Beatrix coolly tilts her head to one side.
You must forgive me. Please. You have a drink with me.
He looks beyond her, towards the back of the bar.
Clarence!
A young woman with long blonde hair gets up from a table.
Dos anillos.
Esteban produces a handkerchief from his pocket. The blonde, whose mouth is bleeding, dabs her wound, smarting from the pain, and looks at Beatrix, who watches her unflinchingly.
Gracias.
She goes back to her table.
What were we talking about?
Beatrix sits facing Esteban, not moving a muscle. She raises her arms in a questioning manner.
Bill.
And smiles blithely.
Where's Bill?
Where's Bill? Bill is at the Via Cuatro, on the road to Salina. I will draw you a map. Bill is like a son to me. Do you know why I help you?
No.
Because he will want me to.
Now that I don't believe.
How is he ever going to see you again?
Back on the paved highway, Beatrix drives along at a steady speed, the Henzo sword in its scabbard beside her. The rounded bonnet moves past clumps of palm trees, silhouetted against the late afternoon sky. Beatrix seems absorbed in her thoughts, her face calm as she drives through the gathering darkness. She pulls up outside a luxurious-looking hotel set in discreetly lit grounds. She strides past the front desk of the plush lobby, the sword slung across her shoulder, the look of focused concentration back on her face. Outside room 101, she pushes through a pair of heavy wooden doors and slips into a spacious private suite. Keeping her back to the wall, the gun held straight out in front of her, clasped in both hands, she turns this way and that, checking out the room. A samurai sword rests in a stand by the steps leading down to the sitting area. Stealthily holding the barrel of the gun close to her cheek, she moves down and across the room, past a bar, to an open pair of doors leading out to a private walled garden. She listens, then swiftly whips round the door, aiming the gun. A little girl mirrors her action.
Freeze, Mommy!
Bang, bang! Oh! Oh! She got us, baby! Mom got us! Oh, I'm dying!
Oh, I'm dying!
Beatrix's face crumples as Bill and BB act out their roles.
Fall down, sweetheart. They shot us.
But little did Quick Draw Kiddo know that little BB was only playing possum due to the fact that she was impervious to bullets.
Impervious to bullets, Mommy.
Hey, get back down there. You're playing possum. So, as the smirking killer advanced on what she thought was a bullet-ridden corpse, that's when little BB fired.
BB scrambles to her feet and grabs the gun.
Bang, bang!
Beatrix watches with bitterness and disbelief. BB looks back at her mother, all innocence. Bill is still lying on the floor.
You're dead, Mommy. So, die.
Beatrix lets her eyelids droop.
Oh!
Her face tenses.
BB.
Fighting back the tears, the bride pretends to have been shot.
Oh! BB! What?
She spins round as if she's been hit.
I should have known.
She totters.
You are the best.
And falls to the floor. BB, in her long nighty, rushes over to her mother and kneels by her side.
Oh, Mommy, don't die. I was just playing.
The bride's eyes open and she smiles, reaching up to brush the little girl's hair back from her cheek.
I know.
BB grins sweetly at her mother, who sits up and hugs her, wrapping her arms around her, stroking her soft brown hair. Beatrix is struggling not to cry. Behind them, Bill sits up, leaning on an elbow.
I told her you were asleep, but that one day you'd wake up and come back to her. And she asked me, if Mommy's been asleep since I was born, then how will she know what I look like? To which I replied, because Mommy's been dreaming of you. That's what I said.
Did you dream of me? I dreamed of you.
Every single night, baby. Every single night.
I waited a long time for you to wake up, Mommy.
Beatrix's eyes, burning with bitter rage, look across at Bill. She lets go of BB and, kneeling in front of her, gazes deeply into every feature of her little face.
My, 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 what a pretty little girl you are.
You're pretty too, Mommy.
Bill squats down next to them.
Tell Mommy what you said when I showed you her picture. Come on, shy girl. Come on. You know what you said. Come on. Tell Mommy, it'll make her feel good.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, come on.
I said, you're the most beautifulest woman I ever saw in the whole white world.
That's truth. That's what she said.
Later, inside.
Baby, don't you think Mommy has the prettiest hair in the whole wide world?
Yes, I do.
Matter of fact, it's better than pretty.
He's fixing BB a sandwich.
What's better than pretty?
Gorgeous.
Very good. Gorgeous. Mommy is gorgeous.
Beatrix watches with undisguised loathing as he stands behind the bar.
You know, sweetie, Mommy's kind of mad at Daddy.
Why, Daddy? Were you being a bad daddy?
I'm afraid I was. I was a real bad daddy.
BB is sitting at the bar opposite her father.
Our little girl learned about life and death the other day. Want to tell Mommy about what happened to Emilio?
Bill slices the sandwich with a very sharp knife.
I killed him.
Emilio was her goldfish.
Emilio was my goldfish.
She came running into my room, holding the fish in her hand, crying, Daddy, Daddy, Emilio's dead. And I said, really? That's so sad. How did he die?
And what did you say?
I stepped on him.
Actually, young lady, the words you so strategically used were, I accidentally stepped on him.
He gives her the sandwich.
To which I query, just how did your foot accidentally find its way into Emilio's fishbowl? And she said, no. Emilio was on the carpet when I stepped on him. The plot thickens. And just how did Emilio get on the carpet? And Mommy, you would have been so proud of her. She didn't lie. She said she took Emilio out of his bowl and put him on the carpet. And what was Emilio doing on the carpet?
Bibi tosses her hair in embarrassment.
Flapping.
And then you stomped on him. And when you lifted up your foot, what was Emilio doing then?
Nothing.
He stopped flapping, didn't he? She told me later that the second she lifted up her foot and saw Emilio not flapping, she knew what she had done. Is that not the perfect visual image of life and death? A fish flapping on the carpet and a fish not flapping on the carpet. So powerful, even a four-year-old with no concept of life or death knew what it meant.
Later, Bibi is in bed.
You loved Emilio, didn't you?
Uh-huh.
Well, I love Mommy, too. But I did to Mommy what you did to Emilio.
You stomped on Mommy?
Worse. I shot Mommy. Not pretend shooting like we were just doing. I shot her for real.
Why? Do you want to see what happened?
No, I knew what would happen to Mommy if I shot her. But I didn't know was when I shot Mommy, what would happen to me.
What happened?
I was very sad. And that's when I learned some things, once you do, they can never be undone.
Bill tickles Bibi's nose. Beatrix watches from across the room.
What happened to Mommy?
Why don't you ask Mommy?
You okay, Mommy? Does it hurt?
No, sweetie.
Beatrix comes to the foot of Bibi's bed.
Doesn't hurt anymore.
She scrambles onto the bed, picking up a cuddly doll and nuzzles up, resting her head on the embroidered pillow next to Bibi.
Did it make you sick?
No. It made me sleep. That's why I haven't been with you, Bibi. I've been asleep.
But you're awake now, Mommy, right?
I'm wide awake, pretty girl.
Bibi, would you like Mommy to watch a video with you before sleepy time?
Uh-huh. Mommy, do you want to watch a video with me before sleepy time?
Oh, yeah, I would love to. Which one do you want to watch?
Shogun Assassin.
No, Bibi. Shogun Assassin is too long.
Mm-mm.
No, it's not.
Well, then, I'll leave you ladies to it.
Bill leaves by the double doors.
When I was little, my father was famous. He was the greatest samurai in the empire, and he was the shogun's decapitator. He cut off the heads of 131 lords. My father would come home to mother, and when he'd see her, he'd forget about the killings. He wasn't scared of the shogun, but the shogun was scared of him. Maybe that was the problem. One night, the shogun sent his ninjas.
Bibi and her mother lie on their sides like spoons watching the video, Beatrix gently caressing the child as her young eyes begin to droop and close. Wide awake, Beatrix strokes her sleeping daughter's face, cupping it in her hands and kissing her gently. Slowly she slides her arm out from under Bibi's sleeping head and raises herself up on the bed. Very gently she lifts up Bibi's legs, freeing the bed cover, and lovingly tucks the child under it. wrapping the soft white cover around her young shoulders. She tucks a doll into Bibi's arms and sits on the bed for a moment, gazing approvingly at the sleeping child, cuddling the doll. Smoothing a lock of Bibi's brown hair back behind her ear, Beatrix looks round and spots a photograph of herself wearing a navy blue and white blouse with blue slacks, posing next to a bridge in Paris, a baguette in her hand. She smiles at the memory, puts the photograph down, and unfastens the delicate chain she wears around her neck. Holding it in her hands with a wistful look, she dangles it over the photo frame so that it appears to frame the image of herself standing on the bridge. She leans over Bibi to give her a kiss goodnight, and rests her cheek for a moment against the sleeping child's body before stepping out of the room. Carefully closing the door so as not to wake Bibi, she peeps back into the room one last time. Her eyes wide and alert, she strolls down a gallery where bright rectangular wall lights alternate with large unglazed windows that overlook the main room. She glances down to the bar, where Bill is sitting on a stool.
I was just admiring your sword. What a piece of work. Speaking of which, how is Hanzo-san?
He's good.
Has his sushi gotten any better?
Slowly, she comes downstairs towards him.
I couldn't believe it. You got him to make you a sword.
It was easy. I just dropped your name, Bill.
That'd do it.
Looking directly at him, she continues down the open wooden staircase, then stops and contemplates him as he puts her sword down on the bar. Her expression hardening with every step she takes, she strolls around the curved settee in the center of the room, which faces a correspondingly curved TV unit on which Bill's own samurai sword rests in its sheath. Languidly, she stands looking at him, then takes a seat, stretching her slender, bare arms along the back of the settee.
I suppose the idea is we cross Hanzo swords, am I right?
She nods.
Well, it just so happens this hacienda has its own private beach. And that private beach just so happens to look particularly beautiful, bathed in moonlight. And there just so happens to be a full moon out tonight. So, sword fighter, if you want a sword fight, that's where I suggest. But if you want to be old school about it, and you know I'm all about old school, then we could wait until dawn and slice each other up at sunrise like a couple of real life honest.
She dives for Bill's sword. He fires, now, hitting the TV.
If you don't settle down, I'm going to have to put one in your kneecap. And I hear tell that's a very painful place to get shot in.
He fires at the fruit bowl, spraying her with mango pulp.
I'm just fucking with you. Now, when it comes to you and us, I have a few unanswered questions. So, before this tale of bloody revenge reaches its climax, I'm going to ask you some questions, and I want you to tell me the truth. However, therein lies a dilemma. Because when it comes to the subject of me, I believe you are truly and utterly incapable of telling the truth, especially to me, and least of all, to yourself. And when it comes to the subject of me, I am truly and utterly incapable of believing anything you say.
How do you suppose we solve this dilemma?
Well, it just so happens I have a solution. Ah! Gotcha!
A hypodermic dart sticks out of Beatrix's thigh.
What the fuck did you just shoot me with?
My greatest invention, or at least my favorite. Don't touch it, or I'll stick another one right in your cheek.
He points the dart gun. She freezes obediently.
What lies within that dart, just begging to course its way through your veins, is an incredibly potent and quite infallible truth serum. I call it the undisputed truth. Twice as strong as sodium pentothal, with no druggy after effects. Except for a slight wave of euphoria. You feel it?
Euphoria?
Yeah.
No.
Too bad. As you know, I'm quite keen on comic books. Especially the ones about superheroes. I find the whole mythology surrounding superheroes fascinating. Take my favorite superhero, Superman. Not a great comic book, not particularly well drawn.
He slugs back some liquor.
But the mythology. The mythology is not only great, it's unique.
How long does this shit take to go into effect?
About 2 minutes. Just long enough for me to finish my point. Now, a staple of the superhero mythology is there's the superhero and there's the alter ego. Batman is actually Bruce Wayne. Spider-Man is actually Peter Parker. When that character wakes up in the morning, he's Peter Parker. He has to put on a costume to become Spider-Man. And it is in that characteristic Superman stands alone. Superman didn't become Superman. Superman was born Superman. When Superman wakes up in the morning, he's Superman. His alter ego is Clark Kent. His outfit with the big red S. That's the blanket he was wrapped in as a baby when the Kents found him. Those are his clothes. What Kent wears, the glasses, the business suit, that's the costume. That's the costume Superman wears to blend in with us. Clark Kent is how Superman views us. And what are the characteristics of Clark Kent? He's weak. He's unsure of himself. He's a coward. Clark Kent is Superman's critique on the whole human race. Sort of like Beatrix Kiddo and Mrs. Tommy Plimpton.
So the point emerges.
You would have worn the costume of Arlene Plimpton, but you were born Beatrix Kiddo. And every morning when you woke up, you'd still be Beatrix Kiddo. You can take the needle out.
She whips the drug dart from her leg and looks at him woozily.
Are you calling me a superhero?
I'm calling you a killer. A natural born killer. You always have been, and you always will be. Moving to El Paso, working in a used record store, going to the movies with Tommy, clipping coupons. That's you, trying to disguise yourself as a worker bee. That's you trying to blend in with the hive. But you're not a worker bee. You're a renegade killer bee. And no matter how much beer you drank or barbecue you ate or how fat your ass got, nothing in the world would ever change that.
He holds up the forefinger of each hand.
First question. Did you really think your life in El Paso was going to work?
Beatrix, her face sweating, grimaces in anguish.
No! But I would have had Phoebe!
Don't get me wrong. I think you would have been a wonderful mother. But you are a killer. All those people you killed to get to me felt damn good, didn't they?
Yes.
Every single one of them.
Eyes closed. She nods her head repeatedly. Her eyes reopen.
Yes.
That was the warm-up round. Now comes the $64,000 question.
He sits on the settee facing her.
Why did you run away from me with my baby?
Do you remember the last assignment you sent me on?
Of course. Lisa Wong.
The morning I left, I was sick. On the plane, I threw up. So I started thinking, maybe I was pregnant.
Easy to use. Remove cap and urinate on the absorbent end for 5 seconds. Accurate results in only 90 seconds. You can read the results as soon as the line appears in the window.
In a flashback, she's doing a pregnancy test in a hotel bathroom, wearing a black vest and pants, her hair wet. She turns sideways to look at her belly and feels her breasts through her vest. With a scowl, she folds her arms across her chest. Her bare feet tap impatiently on the tiled floor. As soon as the second hand of her Rolex watch reaches zero, she grabs the pregnancy kit. She snatches up the cardboard box it came in and compares the chart to the plastic strip in her hand.
Fuck.
What I didn't know was that somewhere on my journey I had been spotted. With me in L.A., it didn't take Lisa Wong long to send an assassin of her own.
Hello, can I help you?
Hello, I'm Karen Kim. I'm the hospitality manager of the hotel. I have a welcome gift from the management.
Well, that's nice.
Beatrix drops the pregnancy strip and stoops to pick it up.
Can you just leave it by the door?
The visitor blasts a hole through the door where Beatrix's head would have been and steps into the dark room. Beatrix hurls a knife from behind the door. The assassin deflects it and fires. Beatrix leaps behind the bed, grabs her own gun, and takes aim.
You pretty good with that shotgun?
Not that I have to be at this range, but I'm a fucking surgeon with this shotgun.
Well, guess what, bitch? I'm better than Annie Oakley, and I got you right in my sight.
I could blow your fucking head off.
Not before I put one right between your eyes. So let's talk. Karen? I just found out. Right now. Not a moment before you blew a hole through the door. That I'm pregnant.
What is this?
On the floor by the door is a strip that says I'm pregnant.
Bullshit.
Any other time, you'd be 100% right. This time, you're 100% wrong. I'm the deadliest woman in the world. But right now, I'm just scared shitless for my baby. Please. Just look at the strip.
Please. Stay where you are and don't move.
The woman, gripping her shotgun, backs away from the bed, kneels down by the door with the hole blasted through it, and fumbles on the carpet for the pregnancy strip. She can't find it. Beads of sweat run down her face. For a moment, she takes her eyes off Beatrix, but Beatrix doesn't fire.
I don't know what this fucking shit means.
The box with the directions is right there.
Karen, in her decoy red blazer, throws down the pregnancy strip and shuffles along the floor on her knees. Till she reaches the packet. She picks it up and starts to read the instructions.
Easy to use. Remove the cap and urinate the absorbent end.
Blue means pregnant.
I'll read it myself, thank you.
She leaps to her feet.
Okay. Say I wouldn't believe you, what then?
Just go home. Same.
The woman, breathing heavily, steps back towards the door, still aiming her weapon, and goes through it, letting it shut behind her. She keeps Beatrix in her sights through the hole blasted in the door panel for a moment, then lowers her gun.
Congratulations.
Back in the present, Bill is sitting at the patio table in the dark.
Before that strip turned blue, I was a woman, I was your woman. I was a killer who killed for you. Before that strip turned blue, I would have jumped a motorcycle onto a speeding train. For you.
She leans against the doorframe.
But once that strip turned blue,
I could no longer do any of those things. Not anymore. Because I was going to be a mother. Can you understand that?
Bill's sword is on the table along with a bottle and a shot glass.
Yes. But why didn't you tell me then instead of now?
Once you knew, you'd claim her. And I didn't want that.
Not your decision to make.
Yes. But it's the right decision, and I made it for my daughter. She deserved to be born with a clean slate. But with you, she would have been born into a world she shouldn't have. I had to choose. I chose her.
Holding her own sword, she sits down opposite him.
You know, 5 years ago, if I had to make a list of impossible things that could never happen, you performing a coup de grace on me by busting a cap in my crown would have been right at the top of the list. I'd have been wrong, wouldn't I?
I'm sorry. Was that a question? Of impossible things that could never happen. Yes, in this instance, you would have been wrong.
Well?
When you never came back, I naturally assumed Lisa Wong or somebody else had killed you. Oh, and for the record, letting somebody think somebody they love is dead when they're not is quite cruel. I mourned you for 3 months. And in the third month of mourning you, I tracked you down. I wasn't trying to track you down. I was trying to track down the fucking assholes I thought killed you. So I find you. And what do I find? Not only are you not dead, you're getting married to some fucking jerk. And you're pregnant. I overreacted.
He drains his glass. They sit, looking at one another across the table. Beatrix, a chiffon orange shawl draped across her shoulders, leans forward incredulously.
You overreacted? Is that your explanation?
No, I didn't say I was going to explain myself. I said I was going to tell you the truth. But if that's too cryptic, let's get literal. I'm a killer. I'm a murdering bastard, you know that? And there are consequences to breaking the heart of a murdering bastard. You experience some of them. Was my reaction really that surprising?
Yes. Could you do what you did? Of course you could. But I never thought you would or could do that to me.
I'm really sorry, kiddo. But you thought wrong.
She taps her sword and sheath on the ground and stares at Bill.
You and I have unfinished business.
Baby, you ain't kidding.
Still sitting, he swings his sword at her across the table. She rocks back, parrying with her scabbard and spinning round in her chair. He hooks her sword from its scabbard, sending it flying, and thrusts at her body. She parries with just the scabbard, and his sword slides into it, sheathing itself. She pulls it from his grasp, bunches the fingers of her right hand, and thrusts them at him, pulling his shirt open. Then she jabs the 5 rigid points of her fingers down hard on his chest. He collapses back in his chair, blood oozing from his mouth.
Huh. Plan A taught you the 5-point palm exploding heart technique.
Of course he did.
Why didn't you tell me?
I don't know. Because of...
No,
You're not a bad person. You're a terrific person. You're my favorite person.
She fights back the tears.
But every once in a while, you can be a real cunt.
She gives him a wide smile. He wipes the blood from his chin with the back and then the front of his hand without taking his eyes off her for a second.
How'll I look?
For a moment, she lowers her eyes, which are suddenly clouded in sorrow. Her hand reaches out and touches his. Then she looks at him with a steady, loving gaze.
You look ready.
She strokes the back of his hand with her fingers and lets go. His fingers tremble for a second. Then they grip the arm of the chair and he stands up. Looking calm and dignified, his grey hair combed back from his craggy face, he buttons up his jacket, hiding his chest wound, and pauses, as if waiting for her approval. Her eyes brim with tears as she smiles at him proudly. Slowly, he turns away from her and steps 5 measured paces onto the grassy lawn before dropping to the ground. Beatrix's eyes are blurred with tears. She gazes out into the darkness and Bill's slim body lying there. She wipes the tears from her cheeks with her fingers, and her face relaxes. Slowly, she gets to her feet and walks towards Bill's body. Beatrix carries Bibi out of the hotel. The child is sleepy, but her eyes are open. The pale blue VW convertible is driven up, its top down. Beatrix gets into the driver's seat. The screen snaps to black, and a caption reads, "Next morning."
Well, 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 if it ain't the little flower.
Bibi, in her nightdress, is sitting cross-legged on a double bed in a motel room, watching cartoons.
Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the ships at sea. Let's go to press. Flash! Do you have a magpie in your home? If you do, you are most fortunate. The magpie is the most charming bird in all the world. He is the best friend the farmer ever had. Treat him gently. Treat him kindly. And always remember, the magpie deserves your respect.
Behind a closed pine door, Beatrix lies on the bathroom floor, cuddling a furry toy. There are tears in her eyes. She stifles her mouth with her hand. She runs her head over the toy animal's fur. As her sobbing turns to laughter, she puts a hand to her forehead, then wipes away her tears. Beatrix comes out of the bathroom, jumps onto the bed and cuddles up to Bibi, kissing her on the cheek. Smiling with delight, they watch the cartoon. The screen snaps to black and a caption appears. The lioness has rejoined her cub and all is right in the jungle. Excerpts from the movie appear, showing the cast from both Volumes 1 and 2. Vivica A. Fox as Vanita Green, a.k.a. Copperhead. Ambrosia Kelly as Nikki, her daughter. Michael Parks as Earl McGraw. James Parks as Edgar McGraw. Jonathan Lowren as the trucker. Michael Bowen as Buck. Kenji Oba as the bald guy. Yoshijuki Morishita as the Tokyo businessman. Yun Kunimura, Boss Tanaka. Goro Damon, Boss Honda. Kazuki Kitamura, Boss Koji. Akaji Maro, Boss Ozawa. Shun Sugata, Boss Benta. The 5, 6, 7, 8s as themselves. Sakichi Sato as Charlie Brown. Tetsuro Simoguchi, Kazuki Kitamura, Boba, So Yamanaka, Issei Takahashi, and Julie Manase as the Crazy 88s. Footage from the ball and chain fight against the bride from Volume 1 shows Chiaki Kuriyama as Gogo. Action sequences show excerpts from the masked samurai fight at the nightclub from Volume 1, the UN Woping fight team as the Crazy 88s. From the same fight sequence, Beatrix in her yellow tracksuit fights a bald Japanese man in a black suit and mask, Gordon Liu as Johnny Moe. Yuki Kazamatsuri as the nightclub proprietor, Lucy Liu as Orenishi, aka Cottonmouth, Sunny Chiba as Hattori Hanzo, the swordmaker. Julie Dreyfus as Sophia Fatale, Bo Svensson as the Reverend Harmony, Jeannie Epper as Mrs. Harmony, Stephen L. Moore, Shana Stein, and Caitlin Keats as Jolene, Erica, and Janine, the wedding guests, and Chris Nelson as the groom, Tommy Plimpton, with Samuel L. Jackson as Rufus, the chapel pianist. Rita B. Bezlucky and Sid Haig as Jay in the Desert Nightclub, Larry Bishop as Larry Gomez, the owner, Laura Kayoet as Rocket, Clark Middleton as Ernie, the gravedigger, and Michael Madsen as Bud, a.k.a. Sidewinder. Gordon Liu as Pai Mei, Daryl Hannah as L. Driver, a.k.a. California Mountain Snake, Claire Smithies as Clarita with the slit lip, Michael Parks as Esteban Vihayo, Helen Kim as Karen, the shotgun assassin, and David Carradine as Bill, a.k.a. Snake Charmer. Perla Haley Jardine is BB, seen here riding in the passenger seat of the Volkswagen Karmann Gear convertible alongside a smiling Uma Thurman as Beatrix Kiddo, a.k.a. The Bride, a.k.a. Black Mamba, a.k.a. Mummy. The screen fades to black. Based on the character The Bride created by Q and U. Kill Bill, copyright 2004, Super Cool Manchu, Inc., all rights reserved. The credits play against black and white footage of Beatrix driving her VW Karmann Gear, her makeup perfect, her lips glossy, the wind whipping her long blonde hair around her face. Uma Thurman, David Carradine, with Chris Nelson, Larry Bishop, Helen Kim, Bo Svensson, Clark Middleton, Laura Kayoet, Caitlin Keats, Stephanie L. Moore, and Vanessa Valentino. As the deadly Viper assassination squad, Lucy Liu, a line crosses out her name. Vivica A. Fox, a line crosses out her name. Michael Madsen, a line crosses out his name. Daryl Hannah, a question mark is superimposed over her name. Guest starring Gordon Liu and Michael Parks, introducing Perla Henry Jardine as BB. Edited by Sally Menke, casting by Joanna Ray, original music by Robert Rodriguez and the RZA, first assistant director William Paul Clark, unit production manager Cornelia Ryan, assistant producer Kwame L. Parker, art directors Daniel Bradford and Liu Lu Ye, set decorators Sandy Reynolds-Wasco and Ma Ying. Special makeup effects, KNB Effects Group. Key makeup, Heba Thoris.here. Key hairstylist, Emmanuel Miller. Miss Thurman's makeup and hairstylist, Ilona Herman. First assistant camera, Gregor Taverner. Production sound mixer, Mark Ulano, CAS. Supervising sound editors, Wiley Stateman and Harry Cohen. Re-recording mixers, Michael Minkler and Myron Nettinger. Post-production supervisor, Peter Mavromates. Special lamp operator, Kim K. Kono. Key grip, Herb Alt. First assistant editor, Joan Sobel. Second assistant editor, Fred Raskin. Music supervisor, Mary Ramos. Gaffer, Ian R. Kincaid. Martial arts advisor, Yuen Woping. Costume design by Catherine Thomas and Kumiko Ogawa. Production designed by David Wasco and Chao Jui Ping. Director of photography, Robert Richardson, ASC. Associate producer, Dee Dee Nickerson. Executive produced by Bob Weinstein, Harvey Weinstein, Erica Steinberg, and E. Bennett Walsh. produced by Lawrence Bender, written and directed by Quentin Tarantino. Uma Thurman, driving her car, winks at the camera, and the screen goes black. Songs: Bang Bang, My Baby Shot Me Down, written by Sonny Bono. A Silhouette of Doom, from Un Dollaro e Testa, and Il Tramonto, Sundown, from Il Buono, Il Brutto, Il Cattivo, written and performed by Ennio Morricone. Courtesy of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Music, Inc., EMI Music Publishing, Italia, SRL. Desire, written by Nora Orlandi, performed by Paolo Orni, courtesy of Gemelli. Ai Che Carai, written and performed by Mary Lou Esmeralda Aguiles, courtesy of Nina Music. A Satisfied Mind, written by Joe Red Hayes and Jack Rhodes, performed by Johnny Cash, courtesy of American Recordings LLC and the Island Def Jam Music Group, under license from Universal Music Enterprises. A Fistful of Dollars, from Per un Pugano di Dollari, written and performed by Ennio Morricone, courtesy of BMG Recordi SPA Rome, under license from BMG Film and Television Music. Can't Hardly Stand It, written by Charlie Feathers, Jerry Huffman and Joe Chastain, performed by Charlie Feathers, courtesy of King Records, Inc. Il Mercenario, Represa, from Il Mercenario, written by Ennio Morricone and Bruno Nicolai, performed by Ennio Morricone, courtesy of EMI Music Publishing Italia, SRL. Title theme, Three Tough Guys, written and performed by Isaac Hayes, courtesy of Stax Records, Fantasy, Inc. Il Mercenario, Larina, from Il Mercenario, written by Ennio Morricone and Bruno Nicolai, performed by Ennio Morricone, courtesy of EMI Music Publishing Italia, SRL. The Chase, written and performed by Alan Reeves, Phil Steele, Philip Brigham, courtesy of Francis Dreyfus Music. Sunny Road to Salina, written by Daniel Bevilacqua, performed by Christoph, courtesy of Francis Dreyfus Music. Ironside, written by Quincy D. Jones, performed by Quincy Jones, courtesy of A&M Records, under license from Universal Music Enterprises. I Giorni dell'Ira, written by Rizzieri Ortolani, performed by Ritz Ortolani, courtesy of BMG Recordi SPA Rome, under license from BMG Film and Television Music. Tumira, written by Manuel Molina Jimenez and Jose Manuel Flores, performed by Lole Emanuel, courtesy of Sony Music Entertainment Spain, SA, by arrangement with Sony Music Licensing. Summertime Killer, a.k.a. Motorcycle Circus, from Ricardo Alamala, written and performed by Luis Enrique Bakalov, courtesy of EMI General Music, SRL. Invincible Pole Fighter, written by So Chun Hu and Stephen Ching, performed by So Chun Hu and Stephen Ching, courtesy of Shaw Brothers Hong Kong Limited. About Her, written by M. McLaren, W.C. Handy, and Rod Argent, performed by Malcolm McLaren, courtesy of Malcolm McLaren. Contains samples of She's Not There, written by Rod Argent, published by Marquise Music Company Limited, performed by The Zombies, licensed courtesy of Marquise Enterprises Limited, and St. Louis Blues, written by W.C. Handy, published by Handy Brothers Music Co., Inc., New York, administered by EMI Music Publishing Limited on behalf of Francis Day and Hunter, performed by Bessie Smith, original recording from the film St. Louis Blues in 1929, used with permission, all rights reserved. The Demise of Barbara and the Return of Joe, from Un Dollaro e Testa, written and performed by Ennio Morricone, courtesy of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Music, Inc., EMI Catalogue Partnership Italy, SRL. Marihuana Salarosa, written by Pedro Galindo and Elpido Ramirez, performed by Chignol, courtesy of Troublemaker Music. Goodnight Moon, written by Ambrosia Parsley and Duke McVinnie, performed by Shivery, courtesy of Capitol Records, under license from EMI Film and Television Music. Yurami Bushi, written by Shunya Ito and Shunsuke Kikuchi, performed by Mi Kokaji, courtesy of Toyai Music Publishing Company Limited. Black Mamba, written and performed by the Wu-Tang Clan, courtesy Wu-Tang Records RZA Productions. Soundtrack available on Maverick Records. Special thanks, Robert Rodriguez, my brother, Moon Sun Quack, Hatsu Hitoishi, Soguishi, Benta Fukusaku, Guillermo Navarro, Mauricio Grant, Peter Bogdanovich, Stacey Scher, Aidan Shen, Sarah L. Driver, Sophia Coppola, Ellie Roth, Rick Linklater, Jerry Martinez. The State of California, Governor Gray Davis, the California Department of Transportation, the California Film Commission, Karen Constantine, Director, Melinda Ann Farrell, Deputy Director, and the STAR Program, State Theatrical Arts Resources Partnership, Alicia Valdez and Cameron McIntyre, Production Specialists. Produced with the assistance of China Film Co-Production Corporation and the Fourth Film Production Company, Hang San Pin and Chui Kuruzi. The Entertainment Industry Development Corporation, Jody Strong, Donna Washington, the Inland Empire Economic Partnership, Nike USA, Beijing Film Studios, St. Regis Hotel, Beijing, China, Samias, Beijing, Royal Elastics, Mike Simpson, Diablo T-shirts, Kurt Russell, George Lautner, Guy Ossery, Rick Rubin, Malcolm McLaren, The Gang at Ruby's, Burt Reynolds, Abe Ron, Tim and Carrie League at The Alamo Drafthouse, Austin, Texas, Dennis Barkos and Chris D at American Cinematique, Hollywood, California, Sherman Torgan at The New Beverly, Los Angeles, California, Eddie Brandt, Saturday Matinee, Los Angeles, Kim's Video and Music, New York, 42nd Chamber of Shaolin, New York, Linda Borgeson, Steve Hudhensky, Barry Littman, Jim Glander, and R.I.P., Charles Bronson, Cheng Che, Sergio Cabucci, Lucio Fulci, Lo Lei, Sergio Leone, Lee Van Cleef, William Whitney, Dolby Digital in selected theatres, SDDS in selected theatres, Digital Sound DTS in selected theatres, post-production sound editorial by Sound Deluxe, re-recording services by Todd A.O., filmed in Panavision, copyright 2004 Super Cool Manchu, Inc., all rights reserved. This motion picture was created by Super Cool Manchu, Inc. for purposes of copyright law in the United Kingdom. Distributed by Miramax Films. As the Kill Bill logo disappears for the last time, Uma Thurman, in her blooded yellow catsuit on the set of the Japanese nightclub The House of Blue Leaves, stands in front of a Japanese fighter. The clapperboard goes, and when action is called, she plucks his eye out.
And action!
Ah!
She grins.
Oh, come on, let's do it again.